By the way, I also, this is an entirely speculative note, and I'm simply going to toss this in as something of an aside. One of the things that has really fascinated me about observing the realities of German history, and again, this none of this program should be interpreted as being anti-German. I have tremendous respect for the individual Germans that I've met, and indeed, my program, for at least for quite a while, and for all I know still, was being played on a major Berlin radio station. But one of the interesting things, my background, by the way, my academic background is in psychology, and one of the things that exerts a profound influence on the cognitive and psychological processes of any given society is their language. The psycholinguistics of a society are a dominant element in helping to shape the thinking and cognitive process of any society. I've always wondered about the ruminated about the German language and its relationship to the German mind. The broad vision of German political and military thinkers is a matter of public record. I've touched on that record earlier in the program. German intellectual culture itself is extremely intense, and I've often wondered about the German language itself and its role in helping to shape the cognitive and intellectual processes of German society. This term here, collecting departments, is one word in German. You know, the Erfassungsabteilungen, I can usually pronounce these pretty well. Erfassungsabteilungen, or collecting departments. That's one word, and I sometimes wonder, this is, again, this may be complete BS, but I wonder about the German language and its ability to subsume several words into one single word, and I wonder about the relationship between that and the German intellect, and political intellect in particular, which has been possessed for a long time of a much broader and more intense vision than the political intellect and the intellect and cognitive processes of an awful lot of other people. So again, maybe complete BS, make of it what you will, but their language is quite remarkable, and I often wonder about that. As one with a background in academic background in psychology and psycholinguistics in particular. In any event, what we're going to look at now is the Allies, that is the Allies at the end of World War I, and their collaboration with the German General Staff, with the industrialists and financiers in post-World War I Germany, and their role in seeing to it that the same elements which dominated Imperial Germany, the same elements which were ascendant under the Kaiser, would dominate Germany after the Kaiser resigned, and which would dominate not only the Weimar Republic, but which would bring about the Nazi Party proper and the resurgence of German military and imperial power at the end at the end of World War I and leading up to World War II. And again, the German Revolution taught the experience of the German General Staff and their political allies, that experience taught them that the fear of communism, the fear of Bolshevism, could be used very effectively as a tool of political and military perpetuation and as a tool of military and political conquest. They made good use of it in World War II. Again, one of the reasons that many of the armies of Western Europe fell so quickly was that not only many of their officers, but also many of the industrialists and financiers and political leaders behind them were really more afraid of socialists in their own country than fascists from another country, and many of them welcomed the Germans in and collaborated with them. The Germans, to a certain extent, the Third Reich soldiers for these particular elements, sort of comprised a sort of coal and iron police, labor enforcers, basically, and they were quite happy to have them around. This was well understood by the Nazi Party and by the German General Staff and its espionage components, and they utilized these fifth column movements in other countries to a tremendous extent. And again, what we're going to look at now is how the Allies at the end of World War I collaborated in order to see to it that the same reactionary political and military elements were reconstituted in post-World War I Germany in order to prevent, quote, Bolshevism, unquote, or communism. Continuing now with The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Ries. The revolution had brought to life so-called soldiers, Soviets. The Allied command in the Rhineland suspended both them and the workers' Soviets during the very first days of the occupation and declined to have any dealings with representatives of leftist parties or to discuss with them any problems such as that of feeding the population, so these leftists happened to be of the same parties that ran the Berlin government. On the contrary, the Allies demanded that only men should be sent to them who had held their jobs before the revolution. The last sentence again, because it's a key one. On the contrary, the Allies demanded that only men should be sent to them who had held their jobs before the revolution. That this strange state of affairs actually existed is proved by many documents. There is, for instance, the report of Colonel I. L. Hunt, H-U-N-T, in charge of all civil affairs of the 3rd American Army in the Rhineland. Hunt wrote, quote, "Many of the ex-imperial officers throughout Germany remained at their posts. In occupied territory, their retention of office was made a condition of the armistice. The political institutions with which the American Army came into contact during the occupation were, without exception, those of the old regime." According to Colonel Hunt, it all worked out fine. The requirement of the armistice that the civil government in the occupied zone should continue to be conducted by the old German officials assured a continuance in office of experienced and competent men. No case of an official declining to continue his duties was brought to the attention of the Third Army headquarters. The autocratic nature of the Prussian civil service peculiarly fits in to adapt itself to the wishes of an occupying military force. And again, Hunt adds, "In the first days of the occupation, the ideas of the great middle class were being revolutionized under the pressure of internal disorder and the opinion of the outside world. This was unfortunate, since it was to this body of public opinion that Germany would have to turn if she were to erect a stable democratic government. Hence, in many cases, our arrival was welcomed by the ex-imperial officials who regarded our coming as being of great assistance in enforcing their authority, which had been weakened by the revolution." The last sentence again. "Hence, in many cases, our arrival was welcomed by the ex-imperial officials who regarded our coming as being of great assistance in enforcing their authority, which had been weakened by the revolution." Paragraph 5 of the armistice, stipulation that occupied territories should continue to be administered by their local authorities, was so interpreted by both Germany and the Allies that, quote, "local authorities," unquote, meant officials of the old regime, period. As a result, the armies of occupation had a thoroughly capable group of officials to carry out their orders and wishes. So again, the fear of Bolshevism or communism basically led the Allied occupation of Germany at the end of World War I to see to it that the old imperial governmental and political officials, as well as the German general staff, were kept in place, and this permitted the reconstitution of imperial German political power and military power, and ultimately led to the rise of the Nazi Party, just as not only more reactionary politicians, but also, as we've seen, the socialist president of Weimar Germany, Friedrich Ebert, also turned to these same interests in order to protect against the German Revolution. Again, this had a profound effect on the strategic and political thinking of not only the German general staff, but again, the industrialists and financiers behind them, as well as the Nazi Party. And fear of communism, fear of Bolshevism, became, for the Third Reich, both prior to and during World War II and the residual elements which survived World War II, it became a major strategic consideration and one which has had an enormous effect on the post-World War II world, one which ultimately, as we will see in weeks to come, led directly to the formation in the United States of the fascist milieu involving the petroleum industry, the intelligence community, the residual Third Reich elements, the American far right, the defense industry, and the American mainstream political superstructure. That milieu, we've looked at the development of it, we've looked at, or the nature of that milieu, we've looked at in the past 2 weeks, in particular, its operation vis-a-vis the Kennedy assassination. Bear in mind that George Bush was part and is part and parcel to that milieu. What we're going to look at now is the implications of the occupation of Germany for the perpetuation of the Third Reich by underground means. Returning once again to "The Nazis Go Underground" by Kurt Rees. Rees writes, "Espionage is not an art practiced for art's sake. It is the gathering of information in preparation for war. The coming Nazi underground will have to organize a worldwide net of espionage, or rather a whole series of espionage systems, because the Nazi underground means war. In the last analysis, the coming Nazi underground is war in itself, or, to change a phrase of von Clausewitz, the continuation of war with different means. The coming Nazi underground is war itself. If we want to get a clear picture of how this war will be waged, it is necessary to differentiate between short-range tactics and long-range strategy. The strategy of the comeback, which may be put into effect 10 or 15 years hence, depends largely on what the world will be like 10 or 15 years hence. As for the short-range tactics, they too will depend on what happens. But since the choice of what may take place inside Germany during the last stage of the war and immediately afterward is limited, the choice of tactics the underground can employ is limited too. The worst thing which could possibly happen to the Nazi underground is a decisive Russian victory, with the Russians alone occupying part, or perhaps the whole, of Germany. The Bolsheviks know from their own experience that it does not pay to be forgiving, so they will be ruthless. They will shoot 100 people in order to be sure of liquidating 10 dangerous ones. They will shut down any number of plants, organizations, or offices which might serve as hideouts for Nazis. They may shut down hospitals if need be. They don't mind confusion and disorder. If they think that they will deal Nazism a death blow by closing power stations, large German cities will go without light. In brief, if the Russians take over in Germany, many of the ruses planned by the Nazi underground will have been in vain. The same thing will happen if the armies of the now occupied countries should go into Germany. The Czechs, the Poles, the Norwegians, the French won't be easily deceived. They know plenty about underground methods. Neither the Americans nor the British will be so dangerous to the Nazis as the Russians and the now enslaved peoples. We know little of the technique of underground work. We will try to be fair. We will see to it that the war criminals get a chance to defend themselves. We will be considerate, and we'll lose time thereby. Well, in retrospect, we were more than considerate. We'll go into that as we examine in weeks to come not only the Galen organization itself, but also the reinstitution in the Federal Republic of Germany, not just of the Galen organization, but also of interests. And we looked at that in a big way in Radio Free America number 2, as well as in an archive show that I did this past spring called The Old Germany and the New Nazis, in which I replayed a section of Radio Free America number 2, and also read into the record a white paper by Martin Lee dealing with the apparent resurgence of Nazism in contemporary United Germany. What we're going to take a look at now is a speculative element of World War II history, something that was going on at the tail end of World War II. Bear in mind, the Kurt Rees book was authored in 1944, in fact, specifically, I believe, March of 1944. What we're going to look at now concerns one of the most enigmatic episodes of the Second World War, namely the capture by Eisenhower's armies of the Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen over the Rhine. It was the capture of this bridge which permitted the armies of the Western Allies to flood into Germany and to occupy most of it. If you look at a map during the Cold War period of divided Germany, West Germany was much, much larger than East Germany. And it was the capture of the bridge at Remagen which permitted this. The Rhine was being seen by Hitler as a major defense line, and the Allies had drawn up to the Rhine. The capture of the Ludendorff Bridge permitted those armies to pour over the Rhine in this major defense line in a big way, and was a major element in the occupation of most of Germany by the Western Allies, and indeed, as Kurt Rees had foreseen in 1944, that proved to be much more conducive to the reconstitution of political reaction in Germany than an occupation of all of Germany or most of it by the Soviets would have been. We're going to take a look now at a book called The Last Hero, subtitled Wild Bill Donovan. That's by Anthony Cave Brown, Cave as in caveman. This book was published in hardcover by New York Times Books and copyrighted 1982. What we're going to take a look at now is the approach, the diplomatic approaches that were made by the German General Staff to the Western Allies, in specifically to the OSS, the Office of Strategic Services, World War II's intelligence service and precursor of the CIA, that headed up by Wild Bill Donovan, William, quote, Wild Bill, unquote, Donovan. He was the head of it. And specifically, these approaches were conducted under the auspices of the Vatican and Baron Ernst von Weizsäcker, who was an associate of Admiral Wilhelm Canaris, head of the German Abwehr, German military intelligence during World War II. By the way, Weizsäcker's son, Richard Weizsäcker, is the current president of Germany. Not the chancellor, that's Helmut Kohl, but the president. And as we will see here, the Germans were indeed seeking to work out an agreement with the Western Allies, which would permit them, basically they were seeking to open the Western Front and to permit the Allies to occupy most of Germany. Officially, that never happened, but as Anthony Cave Brown points out, the circumstances surrounding William Donovan's movements, Wild Bill Donovan's movements in this time period, which were highly mysterious, and the strange circumstances surrounding the capture of the Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen, suggest at least the possibility that, in fact, sub rosa, such a deal may have taken place. This is a speculative note. Cave Brown underscores that, so do I. I suspect, though, that there may be far more to this than what the general public has been led to believe by the conventional history. Reading now from The Last Hero, Wild Bill Donovan, by Anthony Cave Brown, a chapter called FDR's Death and the German Surrender. In March of 1945, Donovan's movements, which were always difficult to track, became exceedingly mysterious at a time when the German General Staff was indicating its desire to open the Western Front to the Western Allies and allow them to occupy all Germany before the Red Army. At least in part, these approaches derived from WJD's, that's William Donovan's, special connections at the Vatican. These had opened up in July and August of 1944, when Donovan held highly secret conversations with the German ambassador at the Holy See, Baron Ernst von Weizsäcker, an associate of Canaris's, that's Weizsäcker. Continuing. The conversations were arranged by, it is believed, Pope Pius XII, for WJD saw the Pope in July. And following the talks, the contact between Donovan and Weizsäcker was maintained, as the Donovan papers show, by Colonel Joseph Rodrigo, R-O-D-R-I-G-O, a regular Army intelligence officer who had transferred to the OSS and was stationed in Italy. Rodrigo's contact with Weizsäcker was through Weizsäcker's counselor at the embassy, Albert von Kessel, K-E-S-S-E-L. It was to transpire that both Weizsäcker and Kessel had connections with important members of the German General Staff, including the chief of the German General Staff, General Heinz Guderian, and Field Marshal von Rundstedt, the supreme German commander on the Western Front. Guderian is G-U-D-E-R-I-A-N. While the matter broached by Weizsäcker and Kessel was an attempt to surrender on terms intended to permit the Wehrmacht to maintain the Eastern Front, terms that were, therefore, totally unacceptable, in Weizsäcker there nevertheless remained a powerful and influential contact with the German General Staff, a replacement for the unfortunate Canaris, who had been arrested after the July 20th bomb attack on Hitler's life and was, it was thought, in an SS concentration camp. The Weizsäcker contact was still in existence in March of 1945 when the Allied armies rolled up to the Rhine for the last offensive against Germany. As a result, the secret war had entered its trickiest stage, one in which the OSS was required to display the most judicial attitudes towards the reports from its representatives overseas, if the Grand Alliance was not to be damaged and perhaps destroyed at the most critical phase of the war, when the nature of the peace was being decided. After several real and false attempts at securing an accommodation with the Western powers, on January 24, 1945, as the German panzer armies were withdrawing from the Ardennes, Donovan advised the Joint Chiefs of Staff that the German ambassador to the Vatican, Baron von Weizsäcker, and Kessel had informed a British representative that they were prepared to give important information concerning General de Panzergruppe and Heinz Guderian, that Guderian, with Rundstedt, was prepared to open the Western Front to Eisenhower's armies. A couple of points here. Once again, I want to underscore that any competent history of World War II or the Third Reich will reveal, it's not hardly a secret, that during the closing phases of the war, Adolf Hitler sought to persuade Britain and the United States to forego their alliance with the Soviet Union and to ally with Germany instead and to conduct an offensive against the Red Army. This would be a reconstituted alliance in which Germany, the residue of the Third Reich, would ally with Britain and the United States and go against the Soviet Union. General Patton, among others, was ardently in favor of doing exactly that. I would also note, too, that Pope Pius XII, the former Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, was an individual whose sympathies to fascism are well recorded. It was then Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, who was the papal nuncio to Munich, who, according to a fellow named John Murphy in his book La Popessa that we covered in Radio Free America number 17, actually began channeling Vatican funds to Adolf Hitler as early as 1919 to help combat, again, the German Revolution, because the atheistic aspect of Marxism was deeply repugnant to the Catholic Church, and so they too were willing to collaborate with reactionary elements. And according to John Murphy in La Popessa, then Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, the papal nuncio to Munich, was actually funding Hitler with Vatican money as early as 1919. Later, the Pacelli family was deeply involved in concluding the Lateran Treaty with Mussolini in Italy, which made Roman Catholicism the state official state religion of fascist Italy. And then when Pacelli became Pope Pius XII, he canceled, basically, a plan by Pius XI to repudiate fascism and instituted a number of accommodations with the Third Reich. We went into that, as well as this particular section from The Last Hero, in the aforementioned Radio Free America number 17, Fascism and the Vatican. Now, skipping down, now bear in mind here that under Vatican auspices, the Germans, the German General Staff, are making overtures to the Western Allies, a proposition to open up the Western Front and to permit the Allies to occupy all or most of Germany. Skipping down, Anthony K. Brown writes, "Now events took a most mysterious turn, which seems to have involved Donovan directly. Donovan left the Western Front for Washington on February 7, 1945, arrived back in the United States on the 8th, and lunched with Ruth, his wife, according to her diary, on the 9th. He then rejoined his headquarters, busying himself with many matters, the most important being his plans for a post-war Central Intelligence Service, the plans that had been so rudely exposed by Trohan in mid-February." That was a Chicago Tribune journalist spelled T-R-O-H-A-N. Continuing, "Yet despite the highest importance of the CIA matter, in the third week of February 1945, something made Donovan leave Washington suddenly, and very secretly, he went to unusual lengths to cover his tracks. Where he went, whom he saw remain a mystery. His OSS records show he was in Washington throughout this period, but his personnel file with the Adjutant General shows that on February 24, 1945, he departed for the European Theater of Operations, while on February 26, 1945, Ruth recorded, quote, 'Bill did leave today for Hawaii.'" Continuing, "It seems that Donovan's journey was connected with a signal sent on February 27th by Eisenhower to Marshall and the combined chiefs that he had, quote, 'received word via OSS channels of a possible approach by one or more senior German officers with the proposal of facilitating an Allied victory in the West in order to end the war promptly,' unquote." Eisenhower advised that he had, quote, "replied to my informant that as these reports have gone to my governments, any action on political levels will obviously be taken at their direction, and that so far as purely military approach is concerned, the channels should be those which are reorganized or recognized by the customs and usages of war," unquote. He ended his message by stating that he had, quote, "no intention of choking off this channel of possible communication with me," unquote. As part of that intention, Donovan's representative at Eisenhower's headquarters, Lieutenant Colonel Franklin O. Canfield, C-A-N-F-I-E-L-D, received a request from one of Eisenhower's staff officers to be ready to take part in staff conversations with representatives of the German General Staff intended to realize a surrender of all German forces on the Western Front. Canfield was to recall that he was not told where the conversations were to be held or with whom they were to be held. He held himself in readiness for several days and then, quote, "so far as I was concerned, the lines went dead and I heard no more about the conversations," unquote. The question, therefore, was whether Donovan flew to Europe to take over this contact. Nobody could be sure because the... Nobody could be sure because of the mystery that always attended Donovan's journeys. As Robert Joyce, J-O-Y-C-E, was to state, quote, Donovan was always flying in unannounced without saying where he had come from. Our long association seems to have been confined to meetings between the two of us between 1 a.m. and 4 a.m. on some highly secret political matter. And then he would vanish in his DC-3, unquote. This was by no means the end of the mystery. While it is known that the Rundstedt talks came to naught, Eisenhower was prepared to accept nothing less than unconditional surrender to all members of the Grand Alliance, including Russia. On March 7th, there occurred one of the most dramatic and inexplicable incidents of the campaign in northwestern Europe. This was the failure of the German General Staff to destroy the Ludendorff Bridge over the Rhine at Remagen, the bridge over which the U.S. First Army flowed to take over vast areas of central Germany before they were occupied by the Red Army. In the period after the Battle of the Bulge, the Western Front was marked by bitter and bloody fighting as General Eisenhower's armies closed up to the Rhine from the North Sea to the Swiss frontier. On the Rhine, it seemed probable, even certain, that Hitler had made that mighty river his main line of defense for the Ruhr, the industrial heartland of Germany, and the entire Reich. To cross that river, therefore, would require the employment of all arms on the scale of Cobra, the breakout operations in Normandy in August of 1944, when four Allied armies were required to crack the German line, a massive, expensive, possibly bloody and unsuccessful campaign that seemed unjustified at this late stage in the war, if a bridge could be obtained by coup de main or a clandestine means. Several attempts to get a bridge using such means were undertaken. At a time when there was great apprehension that the Red Army might occupy all of Germany unless the Allies did so before them, in mid-February, Eisenhower began to press upon his commanders what an official U.S. Army historian would call his, quote, intense interest, unquote, in seizing a bridge over the Rhine. Donovan, who had been at Eisenhower's headquarters in early February just before returning to Washington, could not have been unaware of this intense interest, for in the period in which the Allied armies closed up to the Rhine, there were a number of schemes, some of them involving special means to seize a bridge. But all failed until Remagen. Then, when the U.S. First Army moved up to the Ludendorff Bridge at Remagen, its scouts found the bridge still standing. The German engineers on the bridge had set sufficient explosives to bring the bridge down, but when they tried to activate the explosives, they found that, strangely, the wires leading to the detonators had been cut by, so it was said at the time, shrapnel from exploding shells. Continuing, yet men with suspicious minds in the Allied clandestine services believed there was more to the mystery of the Remagen Bridge than that, although it was true they had little evidence to support their beliefs. To them it seemed inconceivable that the Germans, ordinarily so efficient at demolition, had not demolished the Ludendorff Bridge, the last entry into the inner bastion of the Reich. Certainly Hitler believed there had been treachery. He relieved Rundstedt of command and flying courts-martial shot everyone involved whom they could get their hands on. And Stalin, too, believed that there had been some arrangement between the Western powers and the Wehrmacht. In the course of an acrid correspondence between FDR, Stalin, and Churchill, dealing with allegations that the Western powers were secretly negotiating a German surrender that would permit the Wehrmacht to continue operations against the Red Army, Stalin wrote to FDR on April 5, 1945, You affirm that so far no negotiations have been entered into. Apparently, you are not fully informed. As regards my military colleagues, they, on the basis of information in their possession, are sure that the negotiations did take place and that they ended in an agreement with the Germans whereby the German commander on the Western Front is to open the front to the Anglo-American troops and let them move east, while the British and Americans had promised in exchange to ease the armistice terms for the Germans. Stalin then made a statement that was not correct but was fairly close to the truth, quote, and so what we have at the moment is that the Germans on the Western Front have in fact ceased the war against Britain and America. At the same time, they continue the war against Russia, the ally of Britain and the USA, unquote. He concluded threateningly, again quoting, I think I must repeat that I and my colleagues would never in any circumstances have taken such a hazardous step, for we realize that a momentary advantage, no matter how great, is overshadowed by the fundamental advantage of preserving and promoting trust between allies, unquote. Then, when Roosevelt and Churchill rejected Stalin's accusations, Stalin asserted, again quoting, "It is hard to agree that the absence of German resistance on the Western Front is due solely to the fact that they have been beaten. The Germans have 147 divisions on the Eastern Front. They could safely withdraw from 15 to 20 divisions from the Eastern Front to aid their forces on the Western Front. Yet they have not done so, nor are they doing so. They are fighting desperately against the Russians for Zemlenice, Zemlenice, an obscure station in Czechoslovakia, which they need just as much as a dead man needs a poultice, but they surrender without any resistance such important towns in the heart of Germany as Osnabrück, Mannheim, and Kassel. You will admit that this behavior on the part of the Germans is more than strange and unaccountable," unquote. And then K. Brown continues, "Whatever the truth of these assertions, Donovan's movements between February 27th and March 5th, 1945, or what is known about them, are troubling. We have seen that there was secret contact between the OSS and Weizsäcker, and that there was contact at the same time between Alan Dulles and representatives of the German High Command in Italy, the object of which was to realize the surrender of the German armies in Italy. Moreover, since the matter of the Remagen Bridge has never been adequately investigated, at least by anyone with any knowledge of clandestine operations, it is at least reasonable for the historian to cast a cold eye on the generally accepted explanation for this remarkable event." Skipping down, "The mystery attending Donovan's movements between February 27th and March 5th, 1945, certainly suggests his involvement in very secret activities, and at that time there was no OSS activity more secret and important than the various contacts with the German High Command, which, as we shall soon see, led to the surrender of all German armies in Italy. Indeed, given WJD's personality, it would have been remarkable had he not been directly involved in such a historic matter." So again, we will probably never know for sure just exactly what happened with the Remagen Bridge, but it may be, and this is obviously what I call food for thought and grounds for further research, it may be that in fact such a sub rosa agreement between the German General Staff and the Western Allies was reached, and that the accidental failure of the Germans to blow the Remagen Bridge was something less than totally accidental. We'll never know for sure, but again, with the tremendous importance that the Remagen Bridge, the Ludendorff Bridge, had in allowing the Western armies to pour into Germany and occupy it before the Red Army, given the fact that, as Cave Brown noted, the movements of William Wild Bill Donovan at the time were extremely secretive, given the fact that the German General Staff was approaching the Western Allies, and given the fact that the importance of having non-communists, these relatively sympathetic Western Allies in possession of Germany, would be vital to permitting a German comeback, it's a possibility that has to be very seriously considered. I would note, too, that although a lot of this might seem to be arcane and long ago and not important to some listeners, I can sympathize. As William Faulkner has said, the past is never dead and buried. It isn't even past. And for people who think that perhaps this history that we're going into has no relevance, I'd like to go back once again to The Last Hero, Wild Bill Donovan by Anthony K. Brown. And I'm going to read a section of the author's note, and this is how this particular British historian came to write the first comprehensive history of William Donovan and the OSS. There have been other books about the OSS, but none of them from the official files. In the author's note, we find, "In what was his last act of World War II, Major General William J. Donovan, Director of the Office of Strategic Services, the first American Secret Intelligence and Special Operations Service, and the organization from which sprang the CIA, spent several nights at OSS headquarters in Washington, D.C., with his executive officer, Lieutenant Edwin J. Putzel, P-U-T-Z-E-L-L, Jr., microfilming the director's files. Doing the work themselves, because of the political sensitivity of the documentation, they produced two copies. Donovan took possession of one, Putzel the other. The purpose of this large operation was to provide the basis of a history of Donovan's incumbency when that became politically possible. Now we're going to take a look at what happened to people who started to write the history of the OSS beginning in the 50s, a decade after the war. Several starts were made on work. Professor Conyers Reed, R.E.A.D., the Harvard historian, produced many draft chapters before Donovan himself asked him to stop work because he felt the director's papers were still too sensitive. Reed did not resume his work, for death intervened. One of Donovan's wartime majors, Corey Ford, F-O-R-D, then began work on the project in the mid-1950s, producing a draft manuscript of what was really a biographical history of Donovan and the OSS, but again, death intervened before Ford could complete his volume. After Donovan's death in 1959, the project was taken over by Whitney Shepardson, S-H-E-P-A-R-D-S-O-N, Donovan's chief of secret intelligence during World War II. For the third time, the author died before completing the work. Then came the fourth attempt, this time by Cornelius Ryan, the author of The Longest Day. However, although Ryan had the support of Donovan's friends, President Dwight D. Eisenhower and Alan W. Dulles, then director of Central Intelligence, the work was stopped before it really began. A middle-rank official at the CIA managed to stop the project because he believed the book contemplated by Ryan would be too controversial. When he found himself denied access to the director's files, Ryan was compelled to abandon the project temporarily. Then, he too died before it was possible to resume work. And we're going to find out how Cave Brown now, after four people attempted to do it, one of them was frustrated by Donovan, another by the CIA, and they all died very conveniently before they could complete the work. We're going to find out how Anthony Cave Brown came to be the one to write the official history of the OSS Fryne and Donovan from Donovan's own microfilm files. Skipping down. Now, by the way, this meeting here between Donovan, Anthony Cave Brown and William Casey, who became Reagan's director of CIA, a good buddy, by the way, of Prescott Bush Sr., George Bush's father. This particular meeting took place in 1977 after a meeting of the Veterans of Strategic Services, OSS veterans, and this was while William Casey was a member of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Board. Cave Brown writes, "After the talk, I was invited with other members of the VSS to a party at the El Morocco nightclub, and there I met William J. Casey, who as a younger man had been Donovan's chief of secret intelligence in Europe. Casey was now a member of the President's Foreign Intelligence Advisory Committee and was soon to become Director of Central Intelligence in the Reagan administration. He suggested that I might like to do the Donovan biography. Immediately, I declared that I was not the man for the job because its politics made it work for an American, not a Briton. Casey disagreed, for as he said, quote, an Englishman is not likely to be either a Democrat or a Republican, unquote. And again, I cite this by way of showing that this history that I'm going into, it might seem long ago and arcane, particularly to some of the younger members of the audience, it is anything but unimportant. In particular, I love the way the first four authors drop dead before they're able, or potential authors drop dead. Bear in mind that Professor Conyers Reed of Harvard was dissuaded by William Donovan himself. Cornelius Ryan was interfered with by a middle-level official at the CIA. Certainly, people die, obviously, and it's certainly possible that some of these deaths may have been natural causes or accidental or whatever, but simply from the standpoint of statistical probability, the notion that all four men would die before they finished is quite unlikely. I love the way the author here phrases it. Once again, death intervened, as though death were some sort of deus ex machina being lowered onto the classical stage. I am death, and I shall now intervene. We're now going to go back once again to the book The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Rees from 1944, and what we're going to look at now is one of the major strategic and theoretical considerations as we examine the history of the formation of the milieu that we looked at in the first two installments of Radio Free America 37, this fascist milieu involving Third Reich alumni on both sides of the Atlantic. Both the Galen-linked white Russian people who were entirely responsible for handling the Oswalds in Dallas-Fort Worth, as well as the elements in Germany that were involved with surfacing the story about Lee Harvey Oswald having fired at Edwin Walker, and also the elements involved with generating the myth that Lee Harvey Oswald was a KGB assassin. Because one of the major strategic elements that Kurt Reese felt that the incipient Nazi underground would have to do would be to form operational links with the very large and ongoing fascist parties and fascist elements in some of the Western countries. Now, again, in the first two Radio Free America shows, Radio Free America number 10 as well as Uncle Sam and the Swastika, Uncle Sam and Il Duce and others, I took a look at the American industrialists and financiers who were not only supportive of Hitler from an economic and practical standpoint, but also many of them supported Hitler and Mussolini politically as well, and many of them undertook to establish fascism in the United States. Recall that there was an abortive fascist coup in this country in 1934, and there were very strong, active fascist organizations in some of the Western countries, such as the Mosley Organization in Britain, the National Front, and they had their corresponding elements in the United States as well. And unlike the fascist parties in some areas, the American fascist parties were not substantively dealt with. Most of them had been euphemized in post-World War II history as, quote, nationalist organizations. But one of the most significant reasons to study the assassination of John Kennedy, the most significant reason certainly is to understand the political forces at work. One of the most terrifying aspects of looking at the milieu, which we looked at in our first two installments of this Radio Free America show, is to see an active operational link between the American far right, such as John Birch Society linked elements like the Hunt family and General Edwin Walker, with German fascists, many of them Third Reich and SS and Gestapo alumni, people like Theodor Oberländer. We took a look at Nelson Bunker Hunt's role as the Texas representative of the International Committee for the Defense of Christian Culture, involving people like Theodor Oberländer, a key SS officer and liaison man between the Galen Organization and the Vlasov Army. We took a look at Charles Willoughby, nay, Carl Adolf Wiedenbach, MacArthur's intelligence officer who became an advisor to Franco after the war, people like Hermann Punder, and obviously with the story being floated in the Deutsche Nationalzeitung and Soldatenzeitung of Gerhard Frey, of Lee Harvey Oswald having fired at Edwin Walker and missed, supposedly again Marina Oswald, whose testimony was entirely handled by this Galen-linked group of white Russians, an anti-Bolshevik bloc of nations-linked white Russians. Marina Oswald supposedly disclosed that to the world for the first time on December 3rd, 1963. Supposedly that was the first time the information ever made the light of day. Nobody's ever bothered to explain how Major General Edwin Walker, an active Bircher, fired by President Kennedy for having obliged his troops to study the Blue Book of the John Birch Society. Nobody's ever explained how he was able to relay the information to Gerhard Frey, a German neo-Nazi, with several SS and Gestapo veterans on his editorial staff. And again, there are links between Oberländer and Gerhard Frey, between Gerhard Frey and the Wittico League, a proto-Nazi group which sought to restore the Sudetenland to Germany. That link-up between the American far right and Third Reich alumni, and many of them involved with the WACCFL, the steering group for the World Anti-Communist League, and the involvement of this milieu, the involvement in this milieu of the U.S. intelligence community, as we shall see later, the military defense industry, the petroleum industry, that is a truly terrifying political engine. That is the political engine which came into power on 11/22/63. It is the political engine which is in control of the fate of this country and the world right now, and that is why I'm taking a look at its development this evening. But one of the major elements in the reconstitution of Nazism after the formal military defeat of the Third Reich in World War II, according to Kurt Reese, would be the formation of links, operational links, between residual Third Reich elements and sympathetic, like-minded elements in places like Britain and the United States. We're going to return now to The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Reese, and talking about the value of the Third Reich residual hooking up with sympathetic elements in, among other places, America, Kurt Reese writes, "If I were a Nazi preparing the coming underground at 11 Königsallee in Berlin, what would I think about the numerous, quote, nationalist, unquote, organizations in the United States? We have met SS General Kaltenbrunner, leader of a nationalist movement in Austria. Kaltenbrunner has loads of files. Certainly, he must have canvassed the future possibilities in the United States. We may assume that he has elaborate dossiers on each and every nationalist organization in America for further reference. Even if his intelligence services furnished him with only scanty data about the most important organizations, even if his files contain nothing but what any trained reporter in the United States could find out about them without going to any trouble, surely these dossiers would be far from discouraging to him.